introduce our speaker, who's a friend of mine. I've known him since he came in. And I really admire all of the growth. Him and I have one thing in common. We had a lot of room to grow when we came in. And he's made good use of the time. I want to introduce my good friend, Sean.
Hey, Sean.
I am Sean, I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Sean.
Okay. You know, I never get nervous before I share, but at Club 12, I do, because this is where I grew up. So I put a few notes here because I get scatterbrained sometimes. And I'm going to try to do this entire share without using any profanity. That's an objective of mine today. And I mean, I do that for a living, so it shouldn't be a challenge. But sometimes at AA meetings, I get a little loose-tongued. And I don't want my language to get in the way of the message that I'm sharing with you. I've been sober since August 4th of 1992. So I have 25 years this year. And I am, it's an honor and a privilege to be a speaker at a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and when I'm asked to do it, it's something that I never turn down. I'll preface this by saying that the information that I'm about to share with you is the opinion of this speaker and this speaker only. It does not necessarily reflect the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous as a whole. If you want to know the opinion of Alcoholics Anonymous or what AA thinks, then read this book. It's the basic text of our program, the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It will save your life. I have my third edition, and it has my sobriety date right here written on it. And that's something that I have my sponsees do when I'm working with them, is I have them put their sobriety date in their big book. I have a sponsor, my sponsor has a sponsor, and I sponsor other people. That's how I try to continue what's been so freely given to me in this program. I'm going to try to do what we say to do when we're sharing our story. I'm going to share what it was like, what happened, and what it was like, or what it's like now. I'm going to try not to spend too much time on my drunkalogue, because the truth is that there's not that pertinent of information in my drinking and using, other than qualifying that I'm one of you. I probably did most of the same things that all of you did. I might have done them wearing feathers or latex or something, but other than that, it's all pretty much drinking and using. I grew up in San Antonio, and I grew up being bounced back and forth between my mother and my grandmother. My father and mother were divorced when I was a little baby, and the earliest memory of a father that I have was an abusive stepfather named Amos Ray Britt. Boy, that's a mean sounding name, isn't it? So he was my first stepfather, the first father that I ever knew, and he abused my mother and myself. And my earliest memories that I can remember are being dragged out of bed in the middle of the night by my mother in the wintertime, saying, "Come on, baby, we're leaving. We're getting away from him." And dragging me out into the freezing cold in my pajamas. And we're walking down. We lived in a little house off of Wiedner Road between 35 and Randolph Boulevard, right down the way from a bar. And the house has been demolished now. But she dragged me, and we're walking down Randolph Boulevard, and Amos is pulling his car up beside us, going, get in the car, come on, get in the car, to my mom. And my mom's like, "No, you go to hell," you know, just screaming and yelling back at him. And I'm like, "Let's get in the car, it's freezing." And I was barefoot and in my pajamas. And my mom crossed over Randolph Boulevard to this little bar that used to be there on the corner. And right about the same time, Amos pulled the car into the parking lot of the bar, and they went inside and made up and got drunk together, and I slept in the car that night. And that was the first real memory I have of what I thought my value was. And I'm going to talk a lot about value today, because it's something that influenced my drinking and using. It was something that made up a good portion of who I thought I was most of my life, and I've spent a lot of energy in the course of my life trying to reinforce my value or make myself feel like I had value. And a lot of that was done in the wrong ways. So I grew up with kind of a dichotomy because my grandmother was middle class, very, very clean, beautiful woman, and my mom and my stepfather, we lived in poverty in pretty bad living situations where there was a lot of chaos and insanity. So when things would get really rough and we didn't have any food or they'd cut off the electricity, my grandmother would show up at the door and she would rescue me and she would take me home to her house and clean me up and feed me and buy me new clothes and make me feel normal again. And I loved her. She was the only thing that came between me and disaster many, many times in my life. When I was about 7 years old, she finally took me from my mom because I showed up at the house really, really bruised from being beaten by my stepfather, and she said, "You can't have him back." So she became my mother, and thank God she did. I didn't understand what I was supposed to be doing in this relationship kind of triangle between my grandmother and my mom and myself. All I knew is that I just wanted somebody to love me and make me feel like I was okay. Through school, I kind of had that victim energy because I grew up being abused by my stepfather. So in elementary school, middle school, high school, I was immediately singled out as a target for any bully that wanted to make a name for themselves because I'd grown up cowering from my father, or my stepfather. So if anybody punched me or hit me or came after me, I would just cower. I would never fight back. It's interesting because I think that walking around, my energy has brought on a lot of the events that have occurred with me, and I don't think that I don't think it's right by any means, but I do believe that if you grow up being abused, that inevitably you end up in relationships where you're abused and in situations where you're abused over and over and over until you resolve that energy. I could be walking down the street and saying to myself, "God, I'm such a loser. God, I'm such a loser." And somebody who doesn't even know me could be walking down the street on the other side and look at me and go, "God, look at that loser." Now, I didn't say it out loud, but they can sense that. People can sense your energy wherever you go. So part of my program has been changing my thinking. And I learned how to change my thinking through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because my thoughts become actions, my actions become habits, my habits make up my character, and my character determines my destiny. When I was 14 years old, I discovered that there was a gay bar down the street from my grandmother's house. Not down the street, but like about a half a mile away. And I just knew that these people were going to be nicer to me than the people that were at the school that I was going to. I was a freshman in high school being chased from one end of the hallway to the other every day, kicked, laughed at, spit on, punched, anything that the students could do because trust me, I wasn't by any means shy. I was pretty flamboyant my freshman year in high school. So, but I got on my 10-speed bike, I snuck out of the house in the middle of the night, and I rode my 10-speed bike up to this gay bar, and I hung out in the parking lot at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I snuck in during after hours, and I walked in there, and the first time I went that I was very, you know, shy and had a hat on, and I was trying to kind of hide myself, and I was just looking around at the atmosphere going, wow. And I could see that people were drinking, and I was fascinated just by the whole energy there, and I didn't have a really good time because I was kind of shy about the whole thing. So the next time I went, I put on some of my grandma's pearls, and I just busted out and went to the place. And I had a much better time. So regardless, at a very early age, I was sneaking into gay bars and going home with older men, not telling them how old I was, and doing their drugs and drinking their alcohol and sleeping with them. Needless to say, by the time I was old enough to drink in bars, I'd already been kicked out of most of them. By the time I'd been, you know, drinking legally at age 21, I had already been using and drinking a good portion of my younger life. I don't want to spend too much time on my drunkologue, but I'll give you a snapshot of what my life was like before I came into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Usually, I would wake up at about 1 o'clock in the afternoon, and my objective would be to try to get dressed and sneak out of the house before my grandmother came into my room and told me to make my bed and get a job. I was 22 years old. Before she came in there and told me that I had to clean up my room, I would sneak out of the house. And immediately, my first destination that I would try to get to would be McAllister Park, because I knew if I went to McAllister Park that there would be people there that had drugs, and it was a gay park, so I would go there and find people that I could sleep with or mess around with so that I could get drugs and alcohol. And that was my spiel. That was my game. And then I would do whatever I did to lose my dignity that afternoon, and then around 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock at night, I would start kind of getting ready to head back to my grandmother's house, where I would clean up and maybe take a whore bath, because I showered very rarely. I smelled fabulous, and put on something really interesting to wear to the bar, and then I would start kind of trying to get my grandfather to give me some money, and he was so generous. He was a great enabler. He would give me $5. He'd say, "Here's $5, so you can go dancing with your friends." Of course, he didn't know that I wasn't paying cover. I'd slept with a doorman. I would go to the bar, and if I got there before 10:30 at night, I could get 50-cent well drinks at the Bonham Exchange. And I didn't tip, so I would slam back 10 rum and cokes as fast as I could, and then I'd start working the bar for drinks, working these old men who would hang out there, and two kamikazes and a Long Island tea, and then some draft beer, and then a few more well drinks. Maybe I'd get some shots if I kissed somebody, and then come about midnight, I'd start following people into the bathroom stalls to see what kind of drugs they had, and then. Fast forward, it's 8 o'clock in the morning, the next morning, and I've been at some stranger's house having unprotected sex with them all night, doing drugs. I've done tons of drugs, and I am now in my car, driving, trying to get back to my grandmother's house, and, the sunlight's cutting in through the windshield and burning my eyes, and I look like death, and I feel like death, and I hate myself even more than I did the day before. That was how I existed, and then the whole process would start over. I didn't want to live like that. It was the only thing that I knew how to do. I was unemployable. I had no friends. Anybody who I got close to me as a friend, I would end up using them somehow, or lying to them, or hurting them, and they would banish me from their lives. And usually the line was, "Sean, why couldn't you just keep your mouth shut? Sean, why did you have to do that?" I had no control over my behavior. And even when I wasn't drinking, I wasn't in control of my behavior. I was subject to any impulse that came into my mind, because I had never been disciplined in any way in my life. I was working off and on. I'd gotten a job with Glamour Shots. Do you all remember Glamour Shots?
Yeah.
Where you would, they do your hair and your makeup, and they take your picture. And I'd somehow gotten a cosmetology license at Churchill High School. I was the first male student in the high school to ever take cosmetology on campus. They didn't like that very much. And so I graduated with a license. So I'm working at Glamour Shots, and the problem is I'd come in from the bar, hungover the night before, and I'd get up, and the customers would sit in my chair, and I had no decorum, so I would talk to them about the bar or some guy that I'd slept with the night before, some drugs that I did, and they'd be like, "Oh my God," and then the manager would come over, and it would be So I finally, I'd gotten fired from the job.
No kidding.
So on August 3rd of 1992, and my sobriety date is August 4th. And in here it says August 3rd, but I consider my sobriety date August 4th, because when I came in here on August 3rd, I still had drugs and alcohol in my system. I came into these rooms August 3rd. I came through that door and I sat over there on the couches that were wrapping around that corner. And I sat there in fetal position, and some people came up and started talking to me, and I came over here and I sat at one of the tables right over there. And they said, we're gonna be going into a meeting in a few minutes. Would you like to come and join us? And I reluctantly agreed to, and I went in and sat in the meeting, and I told them that I was an alcoholic, and they asked me to keep coming back. And it was the first time in a very long time that people had asked me to keep coming back. And I was just happy that they were being nice to me. And the truth is I didn't come to Club 12 really because I thought I was going to stay sober or because I wanted to stay sober. I just needed a break, and there were some nice cars in the parking lot, and I thought maybe there would be some people here with some money. And, I mean, I had the whole angle going on of how I was going to work this place, and it fell apart practically the minute I walked in the door. Because there's some pretty streetwise people at Club 12. I started going to meetings in that room over there before it was the smoke tank. It was the 11 o'clock and the 5:30 non-smokers meeting. And I got a sponsor. His name was Ryan. And he had about a year and a half of sobriety. And he looked at me and he said, "You don't ever have to take another drink again as long as you live." And he just said it with enough conviction that I just believed him. I don't know why I believed him. He just said it with enough confidence that I was like, maybe you're right. And we started writing in my big book over there. I think he might have actually bought me this big book. And I started writing down the ways that my life was unmanageable with him. And he talked to me about the way that his life was unmanageable, and I was able to relate to him. And one of the interesting things that I had when I came into these rooms was shame. And shame is the first emotion that I can ever really distinctly recall feeling other than fear, probably. And I just want to quickly talk about the difference between guilt and shame, because a lot of people mix it up. When you feel guilt, it means you know that your actions were wrong, that you know that what you did was wrong, and you feel bad about what you did. When you feel shame, it means you think that you're wrong, that there's something wrong with you, that you're no good, that you're rotten to the core. It is a form of self-hatred, and it is the most useless emotion that I can think of. So I was so full of shame, and I started telling Ryan about the different things that I was doing, and he said, "That's okay. I know exactly how you feel. I've been there too, and I've done that too." And then he started telling me about some of the things that he'd done. And what I really didn't realize is that I was already starting on my fourth step, even though I hadn't taken my second or third yet. He was already starting to break into that shame and deflate that shame. He said that I had to get a power greater than myself. So I told him about my experience with God, which was that when I was 14 years old, I had joined a church youth group with my grandparents, going to Churchill Baptist Church. And it was a good old Southern Baptist church. They had the happy clappy hymns, and I loved it. You know, I grew up listening to that. I loved it. And I was part of this church youth group, and it was all kids about my age, most of them a little bit older. And I had broken down and told a couple of them that I had done more with men than I had with women, and I was ashamed of that, or more with boys than with girls. And they kind of helped me to gain trust in them. And so I decided that it would be pertinent to my Christianity and to my membership at the church, and it would help me to get well if I just told the youth group that I was gay. Because I was going to church or to school with little Bible verses taped to my notebook, you know, trying to pray the gay away. And I just knew if I prayed hard enough that God was going to take that from me and that I was going to, you know, wake up straight one day. So I told my church youth group, and then there was a big scandal at the church, and I wasn't welcome back there again. Mm. And I know, oh, feel sorry for me, please. And so I decided at that point, if there was a God, he didn't want to have anything to do with me. So Ryan looked at me and he said, "Sean, you have to have a power greater than yourself, who you choose to call God." And he said, why don't you scrap your old idea of God that you grew up with and the one that banished you from the church and write down a list of all the qualities that you would like God to have if you could have the perfect God. And that's what I did. At the top of the list, doesn't care if I'm gay, forgives me for all of the horrible things that I've done. Well, a God that'll actually work. I mean, I can still remember today writing this long list of things that I just wished God could be. And he said, now I want you to start praying to that. And I did. And the prayer started out little foxhole prayers of, I don't know if there's anybody up there, but I need help. And he told me that in the morning when I get up, that I should get down on my knees and ask God to keep me sober that day. And at the end of the day, before I go to bed, that I should thank God for keeping me sober that day. And I remember doing that distinctively. And I also remember calling my sponsor sometimes at 1 o'clock in the morning and just freaking out on the phone. Ryan, I don't know what to do. I just feel so strange. I'm so afraid. I don't know what to do. And he'd say, Sean, have you eaten today? And I'd be like, no. I mean, I had no idea even how to take care of myself. I was fighting with my grandparents most of the time, so they were just kind of staying the hell away from me. He said, well, go eat something, and then call me back. I feel better now. He's like, okay, well, let's talk tomorrow. I mean, literally, the people in these rooms would come up to me when I would be I would be spinning out or in fetal position on the couch, which I loved, and they would say, Sean, what's wrong? And I would tell them, well, you know, verbally vomit on them, and they'd say, well, come on in here in a meeting. Sometimes I'd just come in crying, and Miss T, boy, she was a mean old woman, sit over there in the corner. Actually, she wasn't mean, she was really sweet, but she just didn't put up with any shit. Oh, darn it, I said the word, I'm sorry. Strike that from the record, please. But she would say, she would just point, go in there, get in the meeting. And that's what everybody's constant directive to me was, no matter what was going on in my life, go in the meeting, get in the meeting. You're not going to fix it. Get in the meeting. And thank God they did that for me, because it taught me an important connection that in my own power, in my own solutions, was usually more chaos. But when I came to the meetings and I sat in the rooms and listened to people that had more sobriety than me, things just seemed to make more sense. Now, of course, I didn't like the sensation of not having any chaos in my life. It didn't feel right to me. I was just as addicted to the crazy people and the insanity of my life as I was to the drugs and alcohol. So when I had about 1 day of sobriety, maybe 2 days of sobriety, this guy came walking in the front door named Bill Kegley, and he still had charcoal in the corners of his mouth where they pumped his stomach, and adhesive from the heart monitors on his chest, and his eyes were bloodshot, and his hair was messy, and I was in love. My heart was a pattern. And I said, I, this is what I need in my life. And we were going to start on the road of sobriety together. Yeah. And within a month, we were living together in a little apartment over off of East Craig in a basement. And we spray painted the mini blinds and made it look so cute. And we had our life together and we were going to meetings together. I would go to the meetings to see him. He would go to the meetings to see me. I mean, I have to say, there were times that the only reason I went to a meeting was to see him. So maybe God is unscrupulous that way. He'll use what he has to get us to meetings. So a couple of months into the relationship, about 3 months, he started walking around the house looking really lethargic and kind of groggy-eyed. And I knew he was doing something he shouldn't because he looked intoxicated. And I found out that he was taking some pills that he wasn't supposed to take. And I'm not going to say the names of the pills that he was taking, because I don't believe it's appropriate to say the names of medications in Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. Don't do that. Because if you want to polarize a room full of alcoholics, talk about prescription drugs. And newcomers remember the names, and then they go out and look for them when they relapse. So don't do that.
Yeah.
Okay, I will get off my soapbox on that. But anyway, so I found his pills, and I said, you're taking these, and you shouldn't take them. And they didn't have Google back then. I called and looked in dictionaries to find out what they were. And I'm like, you're not supposed to be taking these. And we had this big fight, and he said, well, if I'm already relapsed, then I'm just going to drink. And he took off down the street to the 7-Eleven to go and buy his wine. And I chased him down the street saying, "Baby, don't drink. You can still turn back. Don't drink, please." And try to get him from drinking. And he walked into the 7-Eleven. He went over to the cooler and he got his empty 2020 that he was going to drink. And he walked up to the counter and I screamed at the woman behind the counter, "Don't sell it to him. He's an alcoholic." And then he bought it and started walking back to the house. And I chased him all the way back to the house trying to get him not to drink. And he opened up the bottle. I said, "Baby, you opened it up. You can just pour it out. You can just pour it out. You don't have to drink." And he pours it in a glass. And I said, "Baby, you can just please just pour it out." And he takes a big old swig of it. And I said, "Baby, you can still spit it out. You can still spit it out." Shortly after this, I found Al-Anon. And I didn't want to go to Al-Anon because that meant that I was really sick. But the truth is, I was really sick. But it taught me and the interesting thing is that, you know, I joke about it, but I really did love him because he was the first person that kind of had the same values as I did, that was starting on the road of sobriety, and it broke my heart when he didn't want to stay sober too. And I sat back there in the Al-Anon room that was back in that corner, and I cried the whole meeting because I didn't know where he was and I thought he was probably dead. And those women in there said, "There is nothing you can do. And you need to stop trying to save him, because if you do, you might kill him. Because every time you rescue a person who is in their disease, you lower their bottom and you make it harder for them to get sober. If I'm concerned about my drinking, I come to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. If I'm concerned with somebody else's drinking, I go to a meeting of Al-Anon. And I'm an advocate of both problems and both solutions." So those women in the Al-Anon room with their diet soft drinks know what they're talking about. So, I struggled off and on with chaos and just kept going to meetings. Even when Bill wasn't, I was going to the meetings and working with my sponsor. And my sponsor, at one point, he was telling me to write down all the people that I'd screwed over and all the people that I'd ever done wrong to. And put this list together of people that I wanted to make an amends to. And then simultaneously, Bill and I had gotten in a huge fight because he had drank and he ran off and left me with all the bills. And I called my sponsor and I said, "John, I don't know what to do." I'd switched to my sponsor's sponsor because my original sponsor had drank. And he said, "Sean," I said, "I don't have any money to pay the bills." And he left me with all the bills. I don't know how I'm going to pay the bills. And he said, "Sean, are you making your financial amends?" And I said, "No, I can't even afford to pay my bills. How can I be making my financial amends?" And he goes, "Sean, just make them. As long as you owe other money to people that you've stolen from, it blocks money from coming into you." And I was like, "That is some hocus pocus junk." And he said, "Just do it." So I went around to all the places that I, because I was a shoplifter. I went around to all the places that I had shoplifted from and made arrangements to pay each of them $5 and $10 a week until it was paid off. And I have to say, some of them were really embarrassing because it was like, you know, like $50 worth of false eyelashes at the Kroger. I used to like to get up and drag when I was drinking and using, because you know, it was fun. I usually started out looking really pretty, but unfortunately, I always ended up half naked on the hood of my car in the park with my wig hanging in the tree. Chaos, craziness. But anyway, so I went around and started making an amends to all of these places. And at one, I remember one store, the manager of the store was like, "Oh my God." And he pulled me over and wanted to introduce me to the employees because he was so proud that I was coming back in making an amends. And I have to say that it did change my feelings. It actually made me feel a good feeling of self-esteem, that I was doing the right thing. And I remember one of them wouldn't take the money. And as I was walking out the door, I put the money in the Salvation Army Santa bin and just put the money in there. And I thought, okay, I'm doing the right thing. And this is what my sponsor was telling me to do. And even if I wasn't doing what I wanted to do, I had enough sense that I was taking at least some of the direction from my sponsor. And most importantly, I wasn't drinking or using between meetings. I remember when I got a year of sobriety in that room in there, And they were talking about, you know, they'd read How It Works, and they'd done the traditions, and I knew that they were about to do chips. And I was so excited and ready to jump up because I had a year of sobriety. It was a life-changing experience to me, because it was the first thing that I have ever done in my life correctly. And I don't know if there's a right or wrong way to get a year of sobriety, but I'm sorry, if you don't drink or use or put chemicals into your system, you win. And I did that. Now, if you had to change your sobriety for any of the other things that we do that's sick in sobriety, because trust me, most of the sickest things I've ever done in sobriety, I've done in sobriety. If you had to change your sobriety date for drinking 2 pots of coffee and not eating anything and smoking a half a pack of cigarettes in the course of 6 hours, you know, and walking around crazy, I would have had to change it many times. Charlie used to tell me, she was my sponsor for a while, so she would say, "Sean, you're playing this little game called How Close Can I Get? How close can I get to drinking without actually doing it?" Because I wouldn't eat, I would smoke cigarettes and drink coffee and empty stomach, and I'd stay mad at everybody. And I wasn't drinking, but I was high. I was high on adrenaline. I was high on my insanity. So, at about 3.5 years of sobriety, I decided that I wanted to take my career as a makeup artist back to that. Oh, that's the other thing I didn't share, you guys. When I got sober, my sponsor said, "Why don't you call back Glamour Shots and tell them you think you know what went wrong and that you'd like your job back?" And I called them, and they gave me my job back. And the other thing is, when I was done making my financial amends, I started making money for the first time in my life. It's amazing how that works. And I was working at Glamour Shots, but it wasn't enough money, so I found out through a member of this program that there was a little room over at PT's Show Club, the topless club, where there was a makeup artist and hairdresser that was doing makeup and hair in there on the girls before they would go on stage. And he was coming in on the day shift, or on the night shift, but he wasn't coming in during the day because it wasn't big money. So I started coming in during the day and doing hair and makeup on the girls there. And then I found out that there were some nights he wasn't coming in because he was hungover. And I would come in on the nights that he wasn't coming in. And then I had the room painted. And then I brought in a clothing line. And then I put in a new styling chair. And then I titled myself manager. And I fired the other guy. And he believed me and he left. And no, I've never made an amends for that. I don't even know where the guy is. So at 3.5 years of sobriety, I moved to Los Angeles and started doing makeup in the industry. Starved at first, but started getting some really good work. And came back, met a really successful person, and ended up in a relationship with him for 15 years, living a different lifestyle than I had ever dreamed. He was a doctor working in the pharmaceutical industry. We had a lot of money. I started living in a 7,500 square foot estate with, you know, driving a brand new Porsche and basically being able to buy anything I wanted all the time. And I realized that I was miserable. When it's Christmas, every single day you stop appreciating Christmas. And I decided to, at almost 20 years of sobriety, to go and check myself into the Meadows in Wickenburg, Arizona, because I wanted to see why I was so miserable when I had a good job, a perfect house, perfect car, perfect life, sponsees, long-term sobriety, why I was so miserable. And I went and I checked myself in the Meadows, and I said, "I want you to look at my eating, my sex behavior. I want you to look at everything that I do and tell me why I'm so miserable." And halfway through the stay, I realized that it came back to value. I had been doing everything that I could to get my value from external places. You know, I'd spent my whole life, if I can get this job, then I'll be good enough. If I can buy these clothes, then I'll be good enough. Then I'll have value. If I can get this person to sleep with me, then I'll have value. And all of that doesn't work because it's coming from external places. They explained to me, if I get a $10 bill and I hold it up and I say, This $10 bill is the best $10 bill in the world. How much is it? And I put it in a gold frame. How much is it worth? $10. If I get the same $10 bill and I throw it on the floor and I stomp on it and I say, this $10 bill is the worst $10 bill in the world. How much is it worth? Still $10. Its value does not fluctuate based on what you say about it or where you put it or what it does. Its value stays the same. I have inherent value as a child of God. What I do right or what I do wrong or what I'm wearing or what I look like or how where I work or how long I've been sober, none of that affects my value. It does not fluctuate based on those things. So when I remember that my value is inherent as a child of God, then it makes life a lot easier. My objective today is that I work a program in which I can set an example for those around me, where I can pass the message on that was so freely given to me by people when I came into this room. And it's also to still listen and respect the old timers that were here when I came in, and a lot of them are still here, and I'm inspired by them every day. My friend Tom Harrell, Charlie Rizian, Jim Willis, John Casey, all these people, Claire and Ned, all these people that were my family that made me feel self-esteem when I first came in because I had none of my own. They influenced me and showed me just one day at a time, you come to meetings, you don't drink and use, you work the steps, you work with others. I also have a wonderful development that's happened in the last year. I've found a relationship with somebody who is more like me and less like me than anybody I've ever met. And he's beautiful, and in June, or in July, I asked him to marry me, and he agreed. So. And I'm so grateful every day because he's teaching me how to be humble in so many ways, and he loves animals, and he does his own housework. He doesn't contract it out to some housekeeper, and his life is not on autopilot like mine used to be. So I'm learning how to just be a human being, and I'm grateful for that every day. We don't get this perfect, and that's okay, but my life exists with more balance today than I've ever had in my life. And I still go to a meeting every day. It's my first priority. Whenever I move to a new place, my first priority is to find a meeting and plug myself into it, because Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and it's where I go to get my life force. The other thing is I don't transfer my addiction to other things just because I quit drinking and using. My objective isn't just to not drink or use drugs today. It's not to numb out. It's to stay present in my skin. So whatever's going on, I have to feel it. And if I'm feeling it, it's probably for a good reason. But I'm not going to numb it out with food or sex or shopping or any other thing. I want to be present for what's going on in my life today. I was taught something early on through the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they read it oftentimes at the end of every meeting. And I think it's important information. It says that our book is meant to be suggestive only. We realize we know only a little. God will constantly disclose more to you and to us. Ask him in your morning meditation each day what you can do for the man who is still sick. The answers will come if your own house is in order, but obviously you cannot transmit something you haven't got. See to it that your relationship with him is right, and great events will come to pass for you and countless others. This is the great fact for us. Abandon yourself to God as you understand God. Admit your faults to him and to your fellows. Clear away the wreckage of your past. Give freely of what you find and join us. We shall be with you in the fellowship of the Spirit, and you will surely meet some of us as you trudge the road of happy destiny. May God bless you and keep you until this. Thank you.